Andy, you there?
Yep.
How's it going?
All right, you okay?
Yeah, I woke up this morning and I said, what are we covering today?
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
Your Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garak. Plain, simple.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine podcast. And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro.
Bloody hell.
All right, come on. Should we get on with this thing? Because Blaine's got to get going, hasn't he?
Yeah, we've all got things to do because, you know, it's middle afternoon over there in Wigan.
Yeah, you know, I've got to go to the gym. I've got to maintain this healthy physique, man. Got to keep the woman happy.
I don't know. I've been talking to Angela. I don't know if she's so happy.
I can just see her glaring at me even though she's in the next room. Here she comes.
I've often said, Andy, you better keep her happy because you're never going to do that well again.
No, I'm not going to do that well again. Paul says I have to keep you happy because I'm never going to get as good as you. I am punching above my weight.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's a lot of weight.
there's no one who doubts it. Come on, let's be fair. We all are.
Yeah, that's true.
That's where we're lucky.
Good luck with that. Right. Oh shit, so that means I'm bringing this one in then, doesn't it?
That's why we're all sitting here quietly.
Right, okay. Hello everybody and welcome back to Listen to the Prophets, your weekly, almost, guide to Deep Space Nine and a Two True Freaks presentation. I am Andrew Leyland, and as ever, I am joined by my magnificently wonderful and oh-so-pretty co-host. I stumbled over oh-so-pretty. Mr. Paul Spataro. How the hell are you, Paul?
I do feel pretty. Oh-so-pretty.
You're so pretty and witty and fine.
But, you know, it is truly an example that beauty is in the eyes of the beholder.
I think you're gorgeous.
And as Twilight Zone fans, I think we can all appreciate that.
We can all appreciate that, yeah. And for this episode, we are joined by a very special guest, all the way from Canada, because technology is just wonderful.
We got a tri-country podcast on right now.
This is brilliant. It's like that 1814 war all over again. Mr. Blaine Dowler.
Hello. Hello, thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you for joining us at some ungodly hour of the morning.
That's not that bad when you're already a morning person.
Yeah, Paul's a morning person.
You're a morning person, but it's not morning yet.
Today we will be talking about Tribunal, which is the 25th episode of the second season. It's the annual Let's Torture Chief O'Brien episode. Before we get to that, do we have any Star Trek news to talk about?
I'm going to insert the cricket sound there.
No, nothing. As of this recording, nothing else has happened with Star Trek 3. Nothing particularly interesting is going on. It's just a case of wait and see what the film's going to be like, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very curious, and sadly, I think they've alienated enough people with the first two J.J. Abrams movies that, you know, I may be the sole person to go out there and give an opinion on the movie when it does open.
When it arrives, yeah. Do you think they're in a similar position to DC Comics at the minute?
I would say there is a very similar attitude among the more hardcore fans. I'm not sure how the casual readers and casual viewers are, but the hardcore fans seem very, very turned off by what they're doing on both fronts. So I think that is a fair comparison.
Right. What do you think, Blaine?
I don't know. I'm a little more optimistic about Star Trek Beyond than the upcoming DC films, just because there's enough of a change in creators that they might do something different. I quite enjoyed J.J. Abrams' first film.
Right.
Even though it was really more Star Wars than Star Trek, it's the second one that kind of lost me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who have that. I think that's the most common experience. But I'm not even comparing it, or at least I'm not sure. Maybe I missed the boat on your question, Andy. But I'm not comparing it to the DC films that are coming out. I'm comparing it to the fact that they're talking about rebooting DC comics again.
Yeah, I was more about the comics where DC. If you listen to Brian Hibbs recently on the Hoff panel, that makes it sound like a David Hasselhoff podcast. On Hoff panel, which is a podcast that interviewed him, he was basically saying DC sales are pretty bad. And they have squandered a lot of the goodwill of the New 52, which really sold well for the first 6 months of it. And now they're in a position of having to scrabble around and see what they've done. But like what Paul was just saying about Star Trek, they've alienated a lot of the old fans that they're not interested in what they do anymore. So they're in a very precarious position. And I was just wondering if you thought Star Trek was in a similar position. I know we talked last time about I'm probably not rushing out to see this at the cinema. Unless you come home and immediately Facebook me and say it's really good, then I'll probably consider it. But I didn't watch either of the previous two at the cinema either. So.
Yeah, and I had similar to Blaine, probably not as extreme on the second one, but I would say a similar experience where I enjoyed the first one very much. But the second one, although I can get entertainment out of it and I can kind of turn off the whole stupid contribute at the end, I can still watch the second one and enjoy it, but the second one is the one that really makes me question where they're going with this franchise and what they're doing, and can they gauge what the fans want and still be creative at the same time. Creativity was severely lacking in the second movie. So, you know, and they not only was creativity lacking, but they also did a very piss poor job of gauging what the fans wanted. I think we've talked about this before, but I always thought that if they were going to do Khan, they would have been much, much better off doing a big screen reimagining of Space Seed than trying to do the Wrath of Khan.
And I think they were just onto a hide into nothing. Because Benedict X Cumberbatch is really good, but he's not Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah, that's poor casting.
Having him play that character did him no favours either. If he'd been playing somebody completely different, we probably wouldn't have had as many problems with it as we did. But, you know.
And a huge part of what made Wrath of Khan work is there was the history between Kirk and Spock, and the history with Khan specifically from Space Seed. Like Paul said, when you try to shortcut that and jump right to the end, it didn't have the emotional weight and punch that it could have had, because it wasn't, you know, correcting a decades-old mistake. It wasn't, the relationship between Kirk and Spock isn't what it was by the time they got to that point with the original series, because at that point they'd had, 79 live-action episodes, 22 animated episodes, and they were on the second film.
Mm.
They'd been together for decades, whereas here it's like, okay, the mind meld between Kirk and Spock Prime may give weight to Kirk's side of that equation, but Spock is still just barely past the point of tolerating Kirk, let alone liking him.
They did not earn the relationship between those two at all.
No, not in the slightest. Oh, well, we don't have anything else. Do we want to do a Bible entry, or do you just want to go straight into it today, seeing as we are a little bit pressed for time today?
You know what? I think we should do a Bible entry, because this episode probably will not have as much for us to discuss once we've gone through it.
Okay. Well, do you want to take that then?
Yeah, well, you two talk for a minute while I find the Bible, because I was
ill-prepared
to go forward.
I'm just feeling left out because you've both got your cameras on and I don't have a camera in my monitor.
I only put it on because Blaine had his on and I felt lonely. Yeah.
It's nice seeing you both, though.
Oh, it's nice to be seen. What did we do last, do you recall?
Would have been the collaborator.
O'Brien, Chief O'Brien.
Brian was last. It's a shame we don't have him lined up for this episode.
Yeah, that would have been a nice piece of synergy and would kind of implied that we plan this stuff, but we don't, so.
Yeah, that would be giving us far too much credit. Our next character in the Bible is Jadzia Dax.
Oh, okay.
Science officer, rank of lieutenant, an alien woman, very attractive, late 20s. Dax is a Trill, a joined species, first encountered in the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, The Host. A Trill is comprised of two separate but interdependent entities, a host and a symbiont. The host provides a human body, the symbiont is an invertebrate, androgynous life form that lives within the host. It looks like a short, fat snake. Many centuries ago, the symbionts lived underground while the humanoids were on the surface, and due to an environmental disaster, they were forced to join to survive. As time went on, this mutual support evolved into a biological interdependency, and thus two individuals became one. They speak with one voice. You can't ask to speak with the symbiont or the host, only the combined life form. The symbiont's lifespan is far longer than the host's, and as a result, one symbiont will be combined with several hosts during its life. As we see in the first episode, when a host dies, in Dax's case her last host was an elderly man, doctors surgically remove the symbiont. The worm then burrows itself into the new host. Dax's host was joined with her symbiont when she was an adult. The symbiont part of her is 300 years old, a brilliant scientist and with an innate wisdom who can draw upon a library of knowledge built from six lifetimes of experience. The result of this joining is a serene character who brings a calm, centered voice to any discussion, patient, confident, and wise. You might think of Dax as an ancient Zen master in the body of a 28-year-old woman. There is a subtle conflict within her, a generation gap, if you will. The older symbiont suppresses the youthful instincts of the host, and so sometimes she will seem controlled when a part of her really would like to let it go. For example, the 300-year-old worm has no use for sex or passion, except as it serves procreation. But occasionally, the youthful instincts of the host overcome that resistance. Kira, who forms a very close relationship with Dax, often tells her to loosen up. Dax admires Kira for her youthful energy, her purpose, and her drive, and becomes something of a mentor to her. Dax and Ben Sisko have worked together before. The only trouble is that, back then, Dax was still in the host body of an elderly man, and was something of a mentor to Sisko. Her sexually appealing new form will create a certain tension between her and Sisko, which they will both resist. After all, he's still having a hard time getting used to the fact that she's a 300-year-old worm. But he does not hide the respect and affection he has for her. Okay, I think now this is probably the character that has changed most from its Bible entry to screen. Because psychologically, they don't really seem to go with that whole conflict the way they presented it in the Bible, and they definitely did not play on that sexual tension aspect of it for if they did at all, it was for a very, very short period of time.
Maybe that's why Bashir got nowhere.
Yeah. They don't even have Kira and Dax be that kind of close friends, do they?
I think they developed that, but it's more slow and organic over time. They don't really just jump into it, oh look, they're great friends already. But yeah. I would like to hear an episode of even though it's biology, I'd like to hear an episode of Comic Book Physics on the whole Trill host relationship. So you get on that, okay, Blaine?
Okay. I'll add that to the suggestions list.
Would that be acceptable for Comic Book Physics since it's a DS9 episode?
Oh, there's DS9 comics.
Okay, there you go. Oh, you don't want to be reading those if you heard when we covered them on Back to the Bins.
Yeah, that one's still in the queue, unfortunately. So.
Okay, well, then you have a very long queue.
I do. Yeah, I think yesterday was up to 2015 unheard podcasts. So.
Oh, wow.
Wowzers. I thought I was behind on some things.
I don't leave more than... At maximum, I could have as many as 60 podcasts on my iPod to choose from, and that would be multiple episodes of several shows. But then when I start going beyond that, I just have to pick stuff to say, okay, I'm never going to get to this, and delete them, because there's not enough hours in the day.
Yeah, that's the downside to having the 160 gig classic iPod. It takes a long time before I actually run out of space and have to start making that choice.
No, I actually have the space to keep considerably more on it, but it just becomes so onerous to even pick what to listen to when there's that many things. So, you know, everything gets the short end of it once in a while. When I get too much on there, it's like, okay, you know, I just got to pick and choose. I'm a big baseball fan, and I do fantasy baseball, so those things actually get priority, the fantasy baseball podcasts that they come out with daily during the season. And then comic books will take a second seat in that one.
Oh, well, if we've not got anything, should we go straight into the episode?
I think so. Why don't you just jump in and tell us about this one?
Imprisoned for a crime he didn't commit.
Would you care to make a confession?
In a world where truth means nothing.
What am I being charged with?
No need to worry about that.
And even an innocent man.
Your husband's verdict has already been determined.
Can be found guilty.
His execution is scheduled for next week.
O'Brien is on trial for his life.
I am not guilty. I've committed no crime.
The sentence is death.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Okay, Tribunal, as I've said, is the penultimate episode of Season 2. It's written by Bill Dial. Directed, interestingly, by Avery Brooks, which I think is the first Deep Space Nine actor to go behind the camera.
Do we know if he's directed anything before this?
I don't know if he's directed any television or anything before this.
I'll hit IMDb and have that answer by the time he's done the recap.
Okie doke.
This is good. We may have to have Blaine on all the
time. Yeah, we have to have him on more often. He's bringing a level of professionalism to the show that we're not used to. The plot for this one. Chief O'Brien is just about to head off on vacation, but he can't bring himself to let someone handle his duties whilst he is away. And so he annoys the other members of the command staff with reminders about various things until they order him to leave. While he's on his way to meet with his wife, Keiko, Miles runs into an old crewmate named Raymond Boone. The two had served together on the USS Rutledge before O'Brien served aboard the Enterprise, and long before he arrived on Deep Space Nine. The two old friends chat briefly and then part ways. The O'Briens set off for their trip, but do not get very far before their runabout is stopped by the Cardassians, and Chief O'Brien is arrested. His wife, Keiko, is returned to the station and promptly meets with Commander Sisko to discuss the situation. Keiko expresses her fear and dread about what will happen to her husband under Cardassian Kerr, asserting that the Cardassians use torture to get what they want from their prisoners, and Odo gently confirms that she is correct. Commander Sisko is informed that O'Brien has been declared guilty and sentenced to death, and will have the ceremonial trial in which the verdict is read. He will then be executed. So far, no one has been told what the charges are. On Cardassia Prime, O'Brien is taken to a prison and processed. In the process, his clothes are torn off and he is injured whilst resisting the guards. The judge, who will be overseeing his case, enters and greets him, informing that he will be represented by one of Cardassia's most distinguished advocates. O'Brien, in turn, asks what he is being charged with, and she won't answer him. Constable Odo, thinking quickly, uses the fact that he is still an officer of the Cardassian court as a result of working for the Cardassians' leadership on Terek Noir prior to the Federation taking charge of the station to get himself appointed to the legal team representing the chief. Odo and Keiko promptly depart for Cardassia. Meanwhile, the crew of the station discover that a number of warheads has been stolen from the station and have probably ended up in the possession of the Maquis, a faction that has been attacking the Cardassians. Major Kira looks into the station's records and finds that the transfer of the warheads has been made by Chief O'Brien. She plays a security log containing O'Brien's voice, and in it he clearly requests access to the warheads. This evidence will be used by the Cardassians to demonstrate his guilt before his execution. Lieutenant Dax examines the security log, convinced that O'Brien's vocal command is a simulation. A voice sample was altered into a message that O'Brien never actually said. When Odo offers to produce the evidence, the judge refuses to accept it. The senior officers work under the belief that the Maquis stole the warheads and correctly identify Raymond Boone as the person the chief was talking to prior to departing the station. Later, Dr. Bashir is confronted in a darkened infirmary by a shadowy figure who asserts that Raymond Boone is not a Maquis agent and that the Maquis had nothing to do with the warheads. The crew brings Boone in for questioning, and upon researching his personal history, several inconsistencies begin to become obvious. Primarily among these is that the several major life changes happened around the same time, i.e. getting charged from Starfleet, divorce from his wife, and estrangement from his parents. When Bashir examines Boone, he finds that the man is not the real Boone, but a Cardassian, surgically altered to look like him. His appearance was apparently altered so that he could serve as a deep cover spy in Starfleet. With little time left before the end of the ceremonial trial, Sisko arrives in the courtroom with Boone. The judge sees that the game is up and releases O'Brien. The end. And the end of that synopsis does sum up how rapidly this episode is wrapped up.
Yeah. And that was one of my first criticisms of it, was that ending of it just seems like too bang-bang, that they just jump in, okay, he's here, okay, we're letting him go.
Yeah, it's all too convenient at the end, isn't it?
I vacillate between the whole thought that sometimes they explain things to us too much, like we're idiots and they don't need to do that, and other times they just kind of jump to a conclusion and expect that you're going to say, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, although I think in this time, you knew that this is the conclusion they're going to jump to. I mean, this is Star Trek. One of your main cast is accused of a crime. Granted, it's Deep Space Nine, but we haven't seen where Deep Space Nine is going to go. Like, to me as a viewer, this felt like the mystery structure to me felt more like a Columbo episode than, you know, some other detective show, because there's no question that O'Brien is going to be innocent. He's going to be framed, and Boone is going to be an integral part in it. Why? It's more proving how it was done than who did it.
I agree with you. It does have that Columbo structure, because you see Boone at the very, very beginning, and they let you know he's up to no good with the recording of O'Brien's voice. But my criticism is more lined up with the fact of the Cardassians and what their goal is and what they're trying to do, because they know damn well that it wasn't O'Brien. So why are they trying to manipulate this to make him appear guilty for it? And why do they give up so quickly on that as soon as they see Boone? You know, they really just kind of just jump to that conclusion, and that's it.
Yeah, that's something that Odo explains in the runabout on the way back, although it's just, well, yeah, we could have embarrassed them on national television because the court was being broadcast live. So they could have proved that the whole thing was a forgery set up by the government, and they knew it from the start. And I think the reason they picked O'Brien is just because he's got the feelings about the Cardassians. That's more, oh, here's the plausible scapegoat that we can use for it. And the idea was just, you know, embarrass the Federation and orchestrate a situation where they can clean out the Bajoran colonies on the Cardassians' side.
Yeah, but I don't disagree with anything you're saying there. I just feel that there's some drama that could have been mined there if they had let it develop more instead of just jumping to it.
Yeah, it would have been nice if they discovered that in the course of the episode rather than have Odo just do the expositional dump at the end after it was all said and done. O'Brien's going, what happened? And Odo goes, oh, well, this happened.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it might have been a more interesting episode because, again, you presented that Columbo scenario that I think they play with. So we all knew what was going to happen there. That there's no mystery. There's nothing really to unravel for us there. What would have been more interesting is if they found this out and then the dilemma was, how do we reveal this? Because it's already a conclusion that O'Brien's going to be executed. How do we prevent the execution? How do we go about doing this in a way where the Cardassians are going to let him go and not feel the, you know, that they have to execute him in order to save face or whatever. You know, there could have been some interesting drama to be mined there and some political intrigue, I thought, that they left on the table.
Yeah. And just to go back to the premise made earlier, Avery Brooks has a grand total of 9 director credits. All of them are Deep Space Nine episodes, and this is the first of them.
All right, so he didn't direct anything before. Not even a play.
Nothing listed on the IMDb, but the IMDb doesn't list plays.
Right. I think they occasionally do when it's convenient, but it's definitely not comprehensive. When it's something particularly significant, I think they'll put it in there. You know, it's a fan-run website, just like anyone, so you know, you got to take some of the things from there with a grain of salt. But I would say, for the most part, it's usually pretty accurate, so I would go with that. It's a little surprising Avery Brooks hasn't really, you know, come up in anything else since DS9 went off. I haven't seen him in, I think, anything.
No, I don't remember. Did he do... When were the Spencer for Hire TV movies? Were they before Deep Space Nine or afterwards?
I believe they were before, and he was also in... He was a crime boss in a movie a few years after this.
Right, okay. Well, just to get back to the episode, but I kind of just left you two to talk about it because I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I thought the ending was very pat. Very reminded me of Court Martial from the original show, where the ending's just all wrapped up in an info dump voiceover that isn't even a captain's log. Mm. And this, where this one really scores is just in showing us Cardassian society and how the Cardassian justice system works. All of that's really fascinating, and it's nice to have Richard Poe back again as Gully Vec because there's a continuity to it, and it's nice to see O'Brien and Keiko as a proper couple as opposed to bitching about each other and just running out of the, as he runs off to go and fix something. So all of the character stuff and all of the stuff about the Cardassian society is brilliant. And the first two thirds of it are really quite entertaining as a courtroom drama. And then it just flops at the end. I didn't like the ending because of, like you both said, it's just, here's how we solved it. Because the guy that they pin it on, if he hadn't run away at the end, they didn't have anything on him. Why did he run?
Yeah.
Other than for the scriptwriters to be able to go, look, he's guilty. It didn't make any sense. And so the entire ending just didn't work. But the first two-thirds of it are good enough that it carries the poor ending.
When they first take O'Brien in, and they strip him and basically are torturing him, that did get a little intense. And it was a little beyond the intensity that we've seen, I think, in most of the Star Trek to this point. I would think this... Was this before... what's the episode when Picard is taken prisoner?
Chain of Command.
Was this before Chain of Command?
If not the first, it's one of the first episodes after Next Gen went off the air. The last couple of episodes of Season 2 of DS9 aired after the finale of Next Generation. So... The fact that they even mentioned the Enterprise in the next episode, the Jem Hadar, they could only do because Next Gen wasn't on the air anymore.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, in fact, I saw a comment on that we'll talk about in the next episode. But with the exception of Chain of Command, this is one of the more brutally real, real, put in quotations, episodes as far as what they're presenting and everything as far as Cardassian society. And it gets a little uncomfortable at some points, which is the goal of what they're trying to do there. I think they did a good job with that they didn't make it, they didn't step it up to another level and make it even more intense, because I think they made it as intense as I could deal with on a TV episode and find it still, you know, enjoyable light entertainment without overdoing it. I think if they had gone any further with it, it would have been kind of a little too harsh, and it would be one that I don't think I'd really want to revisit to speak of.
Well, it's one of the things we've talked about before. Deep Space Nine still holding up today because of the themes and the topics of the show. And that one, the Cardassians just stripping and torturing them and basically made up the mind, is still in the news.
And they've mentioned in past episodes how, you know, in Cardassian courts, that's how it works. It's, you know, the verdict is rendered before the trial.
Yeah.
I had some questions about that. I have a slight legal background. And and I had some questions about, like, you know, how does this work? And then basically they explained it to us. They come up with, you know, they do their investigation. They come up with their conclusion. And the purpose of the trial is merely to show how they reached that conclusion. And then I guess it's also to take some information so that sentencing can be potentially influenced by it, because that's the role that Fritz Weaver plays in this, where he's trying to basically have himself throw himself on the mercy of the court to see if he can, you know, get some kind of leniency in the execution. And I think really that leniency would probably have taken the form of how painful his death was going to be.
Yeah.
I don't even think it was okay. You know, you can get, you know, probation or anything. I don't think that was happening.
No, that was not an option for this one.
I liked that little bit at the end, though. That bit, they're going to kill me. That little pause before he delivers that line was really good. So, and again, the acting's really good in this one. And it's going to be a tough one for us to ultimately rate. Because there's nothing actually wrong with it, is there?
No, it's just... Except for the glimpse into Cardassian society, I do see this as somewhat of a forgettable episode.
I'd say that, and O'Brien's speech about his history as a Starfleet officer and his, like, as the career man, reveals a little bit more about O'Brien's background than we had before.
Yeah.
So, you know, he didn't find Starfleet after something. It was signed up for Starfleet as soon as he could. This was always his life goal, and he's in there.
Yeah, I would say that's true, and it gives it a somewhat more gravitas, and Colm Meaney does do a good job. And I've gone, you know, we've talked about him and his role on the show, and how, you know, we have concluded that he was initially expected to play a more significant role and be a more significant member of the ensemble than it turned out he was. And I think he's shown us in several episodes recently that it's not lack of acting ability that has kept him from having a major role, but he just doesn't have that same that same appeal that you need to be, you know, one of the prime people that you're visiting. If we visited O'Brien's life, you know, week after week, I think we'd get tired of him and his character pretty quickly. And I think they learned that.
This is something we have talked about. It's O'Brien's us. He goes to work, he does his job, he comes home, he chills out with the missus, probably watches TV. That's probably his life. So it doesn't make for compelling television. I mean, Cole Meaney's brilliant. Cole Meaney's excellent in everything he does, and he's one of the few of these who's gone on to have an extensive career both before and after Deep Space Nine. Is he in Hell on Wheels at the minute? He's in a TV show at the minute. I can't remember if it's Hell on Wheels or... It's one of those modern-day Western things that I've not had a chance to watch.
Now, I'm getting a real kick out of this every time... Because we actually have the video on. People who are listening can't tell that. But every time a question comes up like that, I see Blaine reach over for his phone.
To answer the question. He's in one of them. He's in one of these modern-day Western things that people keep telling me I should watch because I'll probably enjoy it. And I just haven't got around to it yet.
I have so many shows on my queue. We talked about shows that are on your, you know, podcasts in your queue. I have so many TV shows in my queue, it's ridiculous. Yesterday, because of the snowstorm, my son and I just finished the first season of House of Cards. And we have two more seasons of that to go. We have so much stuff to watch.
Yeah, well, you were right about Hell on Wheels. He is in that one as Thomas Doc Durant in at least 47 episodes so far.
Oh, wow.
He was Wainwright in one episode of Childhood's End on Sci-Fi. And he's coming up as the voice of the grandfather in Norm of the North with three more upcoming projects.
Right. Yeah, I know he's a very busy actor.
Yeah, 114 credits on IMDb right now.
And he's a busy actor in that character actor way that we recall from when we were younger.
Mm, it's, you know, that guy!
Yeah, people in the 70s and in the 80s that you just see them and say, oh, you know, I know that guy. You know, a lot of people may not know Cal Meany by name. But I bet you most people know his face and recognize him.
Yeah, if not from this, it's normally from the Untouchables. The singing one.
The Commitments.
The Commitments, thank you very much.
See, I'm glad I came up with that before Blaine had to reach for his phone.
Yeah.
And then he was also in that, what was the one with Steven Seagal? Is it Under Siege?
Under Siege is a Steven Seagal film.
Yeah, he was part of the... The group that was attacking the boat, the ship.
Yeah. He's in Con Air.
He is, yeah.
In what?
He's in Con Air.
Oh, yeah. It's another gem.
Con Air's fun.
No, you know what? That one, I just remember seeing the commercials for that. And, you know, they were presenting, what's his name? Steve Buscemi as a Hannibal Lecter type in that movie. And then it just never came to pass. And I found that to be so disappointing in the long run that... The whole movie failed for it for me.
Right. Okay, well...
But that has a lot to do with this episode of DS9.
That we're busy talking about Cole Meany's IMDb profile.
But that goes to what I'm talking about, though. It was a good episode. It presented some good acting. It presented some good thought process as far as what the Cardassian judicial system is like and what their political... red tape or political machinations are, but ultimately it's not an episode that's going to stay with you or make you, you know, when the series is over, you're not going to say that's one of the ones that I need to, you know, watch on a regular basis. It just isn't, you know, it isn't that kind of episode.
It's not in the list of episodes you would give to somebody who doesn't, you know, who's on the fence with Deep Space Nine and you'd give them a list of shows to watch to bring them around. This isn't one of them.
And yet it's one that somebody who hasn't watched DS9 could probably sit down and watch with you and get some entertainment out of it, because it doesn't require you to have a deep knowledge of what's gone on otherwise.
True.
Yeah.
All right, do we just want to go and rate this one then?
Well, your episode, you go ahead.
All right, yeah. For all the reasons we've discussed. Oh, go on.
Okay. Yeah, I did want to just make a couple of notes. One of the things that this does establish well, I think, is what sets Deep Space Nine apart from the other Trek shows. I mean, first you got the production design of the Cardassian society and the Cardassian technology, which is consistent with the station, even darker. So it goes along with the line of Galdakots, which honestly I don't remember if it's come up by the end of season two or not, because my girlfriend and I just finished season three. But he talks about how they always keep Deep Space Nine so bright, and it was darker when it was Tarak Nor. And all the Cardassian ones are much darker, so there is a difference in the species. It does really set up the production and show that, yeah, there are biological differences aside from the extra bumps and ridges between humans and Cardassians. So I did like seeing that, and it comes out in the production. But yeah, that's the only piece I wanted to add. Aside from that, as Paul said, it's entertaining when you're in front of it, but ultimately forgettable.
Yeah.
Now, before we do our rating, I'm just thinking, last two episodes we added an extra sequence to our podcast, and I jokingly titled it "What Would Blaine Say?" So if anybody doesn't remember, Blaine has started to send us in emails on every episode, giving his thoughts as he watches them, but before he hears what we have to say about them. And we do have an email here from Blaine that I'm just going to read about this episode before we give our ratings. And I'm just
going to... You don't want to get Blaine to read it.
Well, he doesn't have access to our email box, but you know what? I'm going to cut and paste the body of his email here to give it to him.
I like your first line. Very good.
And there you go.
Yeah. Oh. The first line that Paul cut out.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to delete that. I thought the first line actually had to do with something else that was unrelated to the episode itself.
Well, that's okay. I'll just read it from my sent mail here.
I'll get that as well.
I've got it up in my sent mail.
Oh, so. Okay.
So, first off, I had a hard time making up the ceiling of the set. In O'Brien's cell, were there four lights or five?
I like that. Very good.
Seriously, though, this gave a good opportunity to showcase O'Brien. They seemed to have realized early on that he wasn't going to carry the show, but now they have come up with things to do with him. He's one of the family men in Starfleet, and a speech regarding his loyalty throughout service during his entire adult life says a lot as well. I have mixed feelings about the ending reveal. As with Crossover a couple of weeks ago, it's nice to see references and homages to the original series by alluding to the ending from The Trouble with Tribbles. On the other hand, they just stole their ending from The Trouble with Tribbles rather than write something new. The episode overall was above average for all of Trek, but I don't know that I'd put it above average for Deep Space Nine in particular.
And I think that last sentence is the one that most encapsulizes what I'm saying about this episode. So yeah. We are pretty much in total agreement on that.
Yeah, I think all three of us are in the same place.
Now let's see if our numbers are the same. Now, just okay. Out of curiosity, I do this, Andy. I assign an a rating for it in my mind before I hear what you say. And this way, if somehow you influence me and change my rating, I let you know. Okay, I was going to give it this, but now you've convinced me to move it to this. So before Andy gives his rating and before I say anything that I'm thinking about it, Blaine, I'm going to ask you just in your mind figure out what number you'd assign to it, and then we'll go ahead.
Okay, so just to be sure, you guys are to confirm. You guys treat it's a 5-point scale with 3 as the average, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Andy, run.
Yeah.
It's in the grand scheme of Deep Space Nine. There's some interesting stuff about Cardassia, which will come more into play. We've already established, though, that we don't judge an episode based on how it affects the future of the show. So we're judging it purely on the 44 minutes that we're given here. It's a 3. It's a solid 3. It's not awful. It's perfectly watchable. Anyone who's got a passing interest in the show could watch it and enjoy it. Anyone who's a fan of the show could watch it and enjoy it. And the background details and the acting and the character work is all really good, but the overall plot doesn't hold together in the final act. It just kind of falls to pieces. So I think it's a solid 3.
Yeah, more or less, I'm in total agreement with you. I'm also a 3. I think it probably would be a below average episode if we're just looking at it from the, what does it tell us about Cardassia? But I think some of the acting kind of props it up a little bit. I enjoyed, we didn't really talk about it, but I enjoyed Fritz Weaver's turn as the defense attorney. I thought he also helped it to prop up just a slight bit. So for me, it's a 3. It's an average episode. It's enjoyable, but unfortunately, ultimately, kind of forgettable.
Yeah, as I said, I think it's a little bit below the Deep Space Nine average, but above the regular Trek average. So I'm going to give it an E, which is roughly 2.71828182846.
That's going to make it real difficult. I don't have Sean's spreadsheet ability. That's going to make it a little bit difficult to factor that in, but I will do my best.
Okay. Do you want to do the one and only email we have in the inbox, or do you want to save that for the season finale?
No, I think we're going to have more to talk about with the season finale, so I say we go right to the inbox.
All right, then. Well, I did the synopsis, so you've got the email.
Yeah, he's so quick to just throw it in my lap. Of course, I was so quick to let Blaine read his own email, so... The only email we have at this time is titled Dr. Mora and Mr. Odo, and it's from our friend Gene Hendricks. Andy and Paul, so let me get this straight. The chief of security gets changed into some deranged monster, is supposedly cured at the end, and this is never brought up again? Right. You'd think that Starfleet would order Sisko to suspend Odo from his duties until they can run some kind of conclusive tests. That's not to mention the fact that pretty much none of the people on the station that don't know Odo personally would trust him now. I haven't watched ahead, so I'm just going by memory, but I don't think that this episode has any repercussions for Odo down the line. Don't get me wrong, I like the performances, especially Renee Auberjonois and Avery Brooks, and it adds a good amount to Odo's backstory. But this is just the same kind of story that's been used a lot before. Like Andy said, it's essentially Forbidden Planet, except that this time one of the characters changes into the creature. Like Paul, I would much rather have seen this episode without the Monster of the Week story, since it would have been a lot more interesting. Gene. P.S. I love the scene when Sisko is talking to Jake about Klingon opera, essentially saying, I suffered through this, so you will have to as well. Perfection. Yeah, I agree with everything Gene is saying there, and it pretty much touches on the points that we ran through, except for the fact that, you know, he does hit on the fact that there's no lasting ramifications to it, which is true, because, you know, Starfleet's not going to just say, oh, yeah, you know, we'll just trust that you're never going to turn into this monster again. Nah, don't worry about it. No, you don't even need to send us a report. It's fine. You know, I do think that got a little, it was a little convenient as far as that goes, and while they may have some continuing plot thoughts with Dr. Mora, I don't believe they ever hit onto the turning into a monster aspect again.
No, I think it's telling that I don't remember much about the episode that we're talking about.
This is the one with where Odo's father, you know,
oh,
the father in quotations,
yeah,
comes onto the station.
I do remember. Yeah, I don't remember us having a lot to say about that one. Yeah, I agree what Gene says.
Yeah, I would as well. I don't... I haven't seen all of the episodes of Deep Space Nine, but I have seen most of them, and I don't recall them ever coming back to that.
And that's... You know, I mean, that is the problem with, I think, a series of this nature at this time. I think episodic television has morphed over the years. Now you have series like, we'll use Lost as an example, but I think that's a bad example. Let's use Breaking Bad as an example, where I think the producers come up with a storyline, they know where they're ultimately going with the story, and they try to do their individual seasons to ultimately lead you to that story while creating the drama along the way. So most of what goes on ultimately has a purpose towards the end. Whereas, if we go back, whatever this is, 22 years ago, 23 years ago, whatever it is, I think the mindset was more, we're going to just do a season-by-season show. You know, they were starting to develop an ongoing narrative, but I don't think the end game was ever really considered until they got close to the end game. And it was just like, okay, where are we going to go next? What are we going to bring it to next? And then eventually when they would decide, okay, this is going to be our last season, that's when they'd start to tie up all the plot lines that they had played with. So in doing that, I think they come up with some storylines that don't necessarily have anything to do with where the story is ultimately going. And sometimes those plot lines should have ramifications that they don't. And I think this is an example of that.
I agree.
You know, it's bad when you synopsize a point or when you present a point and everybody agrees with it, because it doesn't actually stimulate any conversation.
No, well, I think that's this episode in a nutshell, though, isn't it? It's one that we've all watched and we've all gone, yeah, it was all right. And that's pretty as much as we can say about it.
Mm-hmm. It is. I find, aside from the original series, most Treks don't really find their footing until they're in season 3. And I think that's true of Deep Space Nine as well. The first two seasons, they hadn't quite figured out what was really going to set Deep Space Nine apart from the rest, aside from the fact that they were on a space station instead of a spaceship. And a lot of that was the serialized storytelling, that they just weren't... They were already doing it to a greater degree than other Treks, but... You know, it's nothing compared to soap operas, to Babylon 5, to, you know, a lot of other shows out there where the long-term planning is evident from day one. And, yeah, this is a case where, you know, it's not really until next week's episode that I think it really finds its footing and says, no, from now on, even if we have pieces that, you know, like Paul said, they may not have known how many seasons they were going to get and what the final season was going to end on. But to me, from season 3 up, it feels like they planned, when they sat down to write the season premiere, they knew what the season finale was going to look like, so they could at least map out, how do we get through this year? How do we get through this year?
And it's an interesting behind-the-scenes thing to think about, is when do they come to the realization, barring a ratings drop, of how do we, you know, at what point do we end this show? I mean, we could all come up with examples of shows that overstayed their welcome. And I don't think DS9 did that at all. And I think there might have been a point where they said, okay, every year we do this, the production costs increase. So when we get through season 7, we're going to have enough episodes for syndication, and the costs have gone to the point where it's not worthwhile to produce new episodes anymore. I think they eventually had that come to be. And I wonder at what point they had that knowledge and said, okay, now we have to start playing towards the end game. And I don't know if we're going to ever see it in the episodes. And I give them credit for that, because I think that, you know, if it had been obvious, then, you know, that would be poor writing. And I think we're going to probably see that the writing was of a high enough quality that you can't tell when they decided, okay, we have to start wrapping this up. Except to the last season, when you start saying, you know, okay, it doesn't matter if we, you know, and I don't even remember if there is anybody who would fit this example, but we can kill this guy off because, you know, there aren't going to be any more episodes anyway, so it doesn't matter. I think they kept the entire main crew alive because they didn't know if they might ever get to the point of doing a movie. Which, sadly, they didn't. I would have liked to have seen it if they could have, but we'll get to that more when we get to season 7, I guess.
Yeah, and if memory serves, there are status quo changes for some characters in the series finale that would make it difficult to bring them back in a movie.
Certainly Sisko.
Yeah, he's the one I had in mind. I don't know.
I know Odo has a major status quo change, but you could still have him come back.
Yeah, and I don't know how many listeners are watching Deep Space Nine for the first time as they go through this podcast, so I don't want to go into details about why it would be difficult to bring them back, but.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And we've had emails that have indicated that there were novels that take place after the series ended, and that they were interesting and good reads. And when we wrap this up, I probably will be deeply enough into this that I'm going to want to pick them up and read them, especially if they're coming highly recommended, which I think is the case. So we'll see. Who knows?
Yep.
Yeah. And I can see the novels working. I honestly, I mean, this is way off topic in a podcast already, but I honestly don't see Deep Space Nine working well in a film, because what I love most about Deep Space Nine is the serialized storytelling that we haven't gotten to yet. And it would be really hard to do that kind of storytelling when you're introducing characters and getting through it in 2 hours.
Yeah.
Look at the first J.J. Abrams film. The villain is barely more than a cardboard cutout, because they've got 7 major cast members to introduce, as well as the status quo for the world for people who are not familiar with Star Trek.
I agree to an extent, but I also think, you know, when something is well written, when movies are well written, you could present an excellent story in 2 hours. And while you would give up the serialized nature of it to an extent, because if you're going to do a movie, you might be able to do several, you could still write a you know, if you're creative enough, you can write a solid movie with these characters who we've come to know and love over the course of 7 seasons. So I think they could do it. I think the reason they don't do it is because they don't feel there's a big enough audience to justify a major motion picture.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. It would be, I'm not sure I think there's additional challenges bringing Deep Space Nine to film than bringing, say, TNG or Voyager to film.
No. Voyager to film consists of Janeway doing a little on-the-screen talk to Picard in the last one, whatever.
Nemesis.
Yeah. That's it. That's Voyager to film. Right? Yeah. Did anybody else from Voyager ever make an appearance in any of the other movies?
No, only her.
Do they not have the emergency medical hologram?
Oh yes, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, he appeared in but that Voyager was still on at the time, wasn't it?
Voyager
will have been on, yeah, when First Contact was made.
Yeah. And it wasn't, obviously, Voyager's emergency medical hologram. It was just the same program activated on a different ship.
Yeah.
It was on the Enterprise. And it was Robert Picardo.
It was, yeah. It makes total sense to have the emergency medical hologram on every Starfleet ship at that point. At least everything made after Voyager. Right? At some point, that'll just be some of it. And, of course, Ethan Phillips was also there in a completely different role.
That's right, yeah. He was on the holodeck.
Yeah, as the human maitre d'.
Yes. All right, well, I think we've tangented enough, and we're going to bleed into the next episode if we don't figure out what we have on the next episode, Andy.
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophet, it's the season finale, so shit's going to blow up. The Jem Hadar.
Blaine, could you come back with us for next time?
I think we can arrange that.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.